You want Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's gets it. We checked the calendar, and Christmas is coming early. $99 is all you need to grab your favorite select 7-foot pre-lit artificial Christmas tree for the holiday season. And don't sweat what gifts to get Dad, because we've got up to 40% off select tools and accessories. That's how Lowe's celebrates Black Friday early. Selection varies by location while supplies last.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. My colleague and friend, Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, joins me as my co-host. We're very pleased to welcome John Hardy of the FDD, who has helped us these last months watch the battle space of Ukraine. Never more important than now, as the multiple players enter into negotiations over a ceasefire and a way forward that does not involve bloodletting. However, all of the negotiators, whether in Moscow or Kyiv or Brussels, will be dealing with a battle space map. It's going to be right in front of them as they talk about a ceasefire and guarantees of peacekeeping along the frontier. So what is the frontier? How do the Russian forces display themselves? Where are the Ukrainian forces in Kursk salient? John, a very good evening to you. The big picture here, the Russians are looking at a spring campaign. We've heard this for some time. How generally would you say the Russians are deployed now in the two provinces that have been at the center of your reporting for years, Luhansk and Donetsk? What does the Russian deployment look like to you, John? Good evening to you.
Well, hey, John. Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me back on the show. Right now, the Russian rate of advance remains pretty slow, especially relative to the pace they were at in, say, November and early December. The two areas that have seen some movement in recent weeks are mainly the area north of Velika Novosilka. This is a small city in Donetsk Oblast. If listeners remember, this is a city Russia took in late January, and they've since been kind of pushing up through a defensive line that Ukraine had behind the city. The risk here is that the Russians can kind of swing left and get behind some defensive lines Ukraine has in the neighboring Zaporizhia Oblast. And then the other area I'd flag is in Kursk. The Russians have made some advances here over the past couple of weeks, and notably they've been really since January pressuring Ukraine's logistic route. The main logistics route through Sumy Oblast into the town of Suja. We've discussed this before, that the Russians have kind of pressed near that town, and they've also been using FPV drones and artillery to hit Ukrainian vehicles moving along that road to Suja. Over the past week or so, that they're also trying to attack into the border in Sumy Oblast to try to sever that road. So the situation there is kind of tough. And I suspect the Russians will continue trying to press toward that road while also pushing probably from the southeast as well, and from the recently taken town of Svidlivkova to try to push down to Suja from the northeast.
What you're describing is in detail a battlefield where the Russians continue to attack and the Ukrainians are on the defensive. The Ukrainians have in these last hours, because they're much in the news, talked about how the battlefield has been transformed from one of tanks and infantry and fast attacks and counterattacks to a battlefield of drones. Is that accurate, John?
Drones are absolutely critical to both sides. I wouldn't say they, you know, replace any other capability, but they do provide a powerful addition, and Ukraine has been really leaning on drones to make up for shortages in other areas and to really be able to interdict Russian forces as they move up to the front lines to launch attacks, as they conduct rotations, etc. And of course, drones are also a key, a kind of enabler of deeper strikes for both sides. So they're certainly critical. And, you know, in recent months, that the Ukrainians have basically, you know, doubled down on their reliance on FPV drones and other types of UAS by investing more in some of their better drone units is kind of a key force multiplier for these understrength infantry units that Ukraine is basically they're trying to lean on drones to make up for that shortage in infantry, which remains their main problem.
Good. That's a point I was going to ask about. You anticipated it. So you would say the Ukrainian drone manufacturing is filling in the holes that are created because of a manpower shortage. Is that true for the whole front line?
Yeah, I'd say in general, the Ukrainian force, they are, for example, right now, I think they're inflicting maybe 60% of Russian vehicle losses, to throw a dart at the board, are caused by FPVs. And like I said, it's important to see these not as a replacement for other things, but as kind of a force multiplier or useful in combination with other things. So, for example, mines might disable a vehicle and force the infantry to dismount, and then you can hit them with drone drop munitions, artillery. You can destroy a disabled vehicle with repeated FPV drone strikes. And so these work really well in combination with other systems. That's traditionally when a system is going to be most effective, it's employed in a combined arms way that kind of makes up for the weaknesses of other things and can accentuate the strengths. So, as I say, Ukraine has really been leaning on drones, and some of their better units are really able to, for example, Birds of Madyar, a new brigade they've stood up based on a regiment that was really successful, now expanding into a brigade. They're kind of doing that with other units, turning battalions into regiments, et cetera, to kind of scale up these most successful units and kind of spread their experience and tactics and techniques across the battlefield.
Bill, you have a question for John.
Hello, John. A common narrative is that Russia's been, for the last two-plus years, Russia's been running out of men and material, armored vehicles, tanks, et cetera. And yet Russia's been on the offensive for almost a year and a half now. How can both of these things be true at the same time? Certainly Russia is taking losses, but how is it able to sustain that offensive for as long as it has?
Well, really the key thing has been a high recruitment of manpower, using these really lucrative contracts that basically high above the whatever the average might be in a particular region of Russia. They'll offer a contract that's well above that. And those sums have been growing dramatically, over the past year, especially in late 2024. So far the Russians have maintained a recruitment rate that's sufficient to replace losses. And over the past couple of years, they've also expanded the force, with creating additional units and moving those into Ukraine. So the Russian force in and around Ukraine has certainly grown significantly over the past couple of years. I think with equipment, they're certainly not out of tanks. They're not out of IFVs. In fact, the IFVs are really probably the bigger vulnerability rather than tanks. They're not out of equipment. You still see them use, conduct mechanized assaults, but certainly that their stores are much lower than they were at the beginning of the year. I wouldn't say that, I'd expect them to run out of tanks and IFVs by 2026, but they'll have much less to work with, and so I think that'll you've already seen them lean more heavily on light vehicles or ATVs and other things, and so I think they'll continue to do that. They can still conduct assaults if they don't have enough BMPs or MTLBs. It just means less protection and perhaps a higher casualty rate for those assault troops and perhaps a slower rate of gain. Okay. So. I think that the Russians, they just kind of face that dynamic, and I think a key kind of variable going forward is whether Ukraine can fix its own manpower problem. If it can, I think it really has a good chance of stabilizing its lines as the Russians continue to struggle. But if it can't, that's a different conversation.
A quick look at the Kursk salient. Any significant change? I remember you saying about a third of it is firmly in Ukrainian hands. Russians responding to that.
Right. So I think we covered this pretty well earlier. I just add that, as the Russians push closer to Suja, as they try to cut across into that, to sever that that main ground line of communication from the city of Sumy to Yunikivka to Suja, you know, that Ukrainian salient is at increased risk, kind of being cut off at the neck. So, you know, I suspect the Ukrainians will try to take some measures to stabilize that situation and kind of push back on those flanks to protect Suja. And we'll just have to see how it plays out.
What's the scale of the Ukrainian commitment to Kerch salient? Do we have a number?
Yes, I think it's, you know, remained with some of their best brigades kind of in that area, 82nd, 80th, 47th. I don't know if I have a firm number of troops, but, you know, you haven't seen, certainly haven't seen the Ukrainians withdraw en masse from there. I think their commitment to Kursk has remained fairly steady. Although, you know, of course, units have rotated out, you know, over the course of the months that they've been there.
5,000, 10,000, what number do we have of the, do we have any number like that in the Kursk salient?
So I think for the Russians, it's maybe around 50,000. You know, again, that's not encumbered at any one time, but maybe committed to that operation, 50, 60, you know, plus the North Koreans. For Ukraine, maybe, you know, half that, just throwing a dart at the board.
John Hardy of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy giving us the battle space that the negotiators will look at as they talk about an end to the fighting. Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, keeps the Long War Journal. When we come back, politics in Ukraine and Moscow and London and Washington and Brussels. You understand. This is a meeting of minds of the leaders at opposite versions of the war.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.